TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Yanis Varoufakis, How Capitalism Works and How It Fails. There are few people with the expertise, life experience, and conviction that empower them to challenge the current economic system that is called capitalism. Yanis Varoufakis is one of them, and he goes a step further than most by proposing reforms, not just for his home Greece and the European Union, of which Greece is a part, but for the banking systems that dominate the world these days. Yanis Varoufakis was already an internationally known economist and academic when he was elected to the Greek Parliament as a member of the Syriza Party. At the height of the Greek debt crisis, he served as Minister of Finance from January to July 2015. He was among the leaders of what he calls a prison break, the Greek people's short-lived attempt to escape from the crushing cycle of debt and fiscal austerity that had starved their welfare state and nearly destroyed their society. Varoufakis' Syriza party capitulated to the demands of the IMF and the European Central Bank, which it had specifically promised not to do, and he resigned as finance minister. Varoufakis denounced the troika of lenders for forcing Greece to accept bailout loans that then were used to bail out the banks. Varoufakis said that this was a transfer of losses from private banks to Greece's and Europe's taxpayers, similar to the 2008 bailout of banks in the US. Interestingly, Varoufakis argues that in 2008, the capitalist system received a mortal blow that is slowly becoming apparent and will lead to another crash. One consequence is the rise of fascism in Europe and in the US. Donald Trump is not unique to the US, Varoufakis says. He is everywhere. But there's another positive legacy from the US that might protect democracy from capitalism. Varoufakis is an expert on the American New Deal, and he proposes that a new deal for the European Union and ultimately the world can protect democracy from capitalism. In the previous TUC radio program, you heard Varoufakis' May 2018 speech at Town Hall, Seattle. In this program, he answers questions from the audience, beginning with, "What is the role of economists in empowering people?"
Why don't we just try something that is not often being tried? Common sense. Anybody that tries to bamboozle you with very complicated theories and models and concepts should immediately be dismissed. But some basic ideas that we have an economic surplus, which is absolutely essential for civilization. So we need to produce a little bit more than what we consume to replace that which we have expended. So if you have a farm, in order to have development, you need at the end of the season to end up with a little bit more corn than what you started with so that you can plant again for the next season and so on. So you have an economic surplus. And the greater that economic surplus is, the more you can do with it. More you can invest in education, the more you can invest in the things that society wants. So, surplus is an important concept to have. Okay? Then let's have a discussion about what that surplus should be. Because we know very well that we have done a magnificent job at destroying this environment of ours. So, I don't think we need more SUVs to be part of that surplus. And we need a lot more effective prevention of diseases. We need more care for elderly people, but that needs more surplus so that the carers, the maintainers of our society, can be maintained themselves. We need more green energy so that we do not produce CO2 and so on and so on. So, okay, we proceed from there. Then the question of debt. How much debt do we need in order to generate the surplus which is necessary for socially useful purposes, and what kind of debt? Do we need those financial instruments of Wall Street? And also, I'm a great believer in identities as opposed to equations. Equations are theories. In physics, they're great. In economics, they don't work. Because all economic theories, I love economic theory, I'm an economic theorist. But I like economic theory in the same way I like chess. Chess is a fantastic game to play. It sharpens the mind. If you try to apply it in daily life or on the battlefield, you're a complete and utter disaster. Imagine treating other people as if they're pawns or going to war and planning your campaign as if it's a chessboard. And the rules are given by some God-given entity. So equations theory. Identities, however, are important. So for instance, let me give you an example. Austerity. Why is austerity such a dangerous idea? Why does it never, ever work? It has never worked in the history of humanity. It will never work in the history of humanity. Never. You see, what the supporters of austerity try to do is they try to confuse us by identifying parsimony, frugality, with austerity. No comparison, no connection. And let me explain this in terms of an identity so that you understand why I'm saying identities are important and equations should be left outside. Look, if you and I cannot make ends meet because our income is too low and our expenditure is too high, now we have to tighten our belt. I do believe in belt tightening at a personal level. If you don't tighten your belt and you continue to spend more than you earn, you are going to be in serious trouble. It is stupid to do it. Yeah? But take 2008, or even today, but let's go to 2008, because 2008 is a very good example of a great recession. Yeah? So what happens is, the private sector goes into a spasm. They stop investing. They fire people. So in other words, to put it bluntly, the private sector shrinks its expenditure. As it shrinks its expenditure, incomes shrink. The tax take of the federal government comes down. If the finance minister, your treasury secretary, panics and says, oh my goodness, I should apply belt tightening at the level of the economy because my income, the income of the state, is coming down. That is a catastrophe. Why? Because the state does not operate like a family. But remember before I said that nature doesn't give a damn about our theories because it's independent of our theories. Similarly, you and I can make ends meet by belt tightening for the simple reason that our income is independent of our expenditure. If you and I tonight decide to save some money and not go to a restaurant and stay at home and, you know, cook some pasta at home, we will save some money. Our income is not going to decline. Our income is independent of whether we go to the restaurant or not. But the Treasury Secretary, if in the middle of a recession when private expenditure is coming down, if he or she, it's usually he, shrinks public expenditure, that's austerity in other words, cuts pensions, cuts social programs and so on and so forth, what's going to happen? What's going to happen is this. Public expenditure is going to come down at the time when private expenditure is coming down. The sum of private and public expenditure is going to come down. What is this necessarily equal to? That's the identity. Always equal to. This is not a theory. It's a fact. The total expenditure, private and public, is national income. So what will happen is national income will shrink faster. As national income shrinks faster as a result of austerity, of cutting social programs and social expenditure, what happens is the tax take goes down. So because the tax take went down initially, the Treasury reduced expenditure, thinking that now we're going to, you know, to balance the books. But no, because this reduction in expenditure pushes the tax take even further. And then if you react to this by pushing expenditure further down, you become Greece. No, seriously. This is what happened in Greece. We are in a state of a Great Depression in Greece. We've reduced wages by 40%, pensions by 48%, and you know what happened? Our national income went down by 28%, which is what happened in this country between 1929 and 1933. So we have a Great Depression. George Steinbeck come back to write in Greek The Grapes of Wrath. We have a Nazi party in parliament. If we understood our identities and forget about the theories and forget about the experts who always adopt theories that suit the bankers and the powers that be, we would be all better off. This was a very long answer, I'm sorry. Next.
Yanis, you ended your first edition of the Global Minotaur with a speculation, not a prediction, that the Global Minotaur was dead.
Mortally wounded.
What would replace it? What would come after?
Somebody who's read the book.
Even to the last paragraph. Is the Minotaur dead? We still have a Treasury Secretary from Goldman Sachs.
That's standard. Yeah. All governments change. Goldman Sachs remains.
Democrat, Republican, we have Treasury Secretary from Goldman Sachs.
Well, allow me to say what happened in the end. Yes, I do believe that the Global Minotaur remains mortally wounded, or probably gone. He's a goner. And I'll explain in a minute what I mean by what this metaphor is. And the result is Donald Trump. Everywhere. Not just in the United States. Do you realize Trump is an international movement? You know, I met somebody from Austria today. We have an ultra-right-wing government in Austria. The Austrian minister for the police and the intelligence services is a neo-Nazi. In Austria, in the land of you know, the most enlightened people on earth, of Kreisky, we have a Nazi in charge of the intelligence services and of the police. So we have Trump everywhere now, or almost everywhere, and things are not looking very good. But allow me just very briefly, the Global Minotaur was a metaphor I used in a book that I wrote in 2010 sometime. What followed Bretton Woods? Remember Bretton Woods? Bretton Woods is a system that the new dealers in this country created. It was effectively the internationalization of the New Deal. The FDR administration took the New Deal institutions and extended them, turned them into an umbrella. And under that umbrella, we had Europe, and it was in that context that the European Union became possible, and Japan. And the Bretton Woods system was an interesting system. You had effectively a common currency. The dollar was the common currency, but with capital controls, with huge restrictions on what the bankers could do. Goldman Sachs was very unhappy, thankfully. And the American surpluses, because America was the only surplus country after the war, it was the only creditor nation. It was the only country that exported more than it imported. So a significant chunk of American profits was being exported to Europe and to Japan to allow the Europeans and the Japanese to buy American. It was not philanthropy, it was just smart hegemony. But then after the 1970s, when that system collapsed, because this country stopped having a surplus, it became a deficit country, what we had was a situation where the net exports of the rest of the world were coming to this country. Your trade deficit made sure of that. It was operating as a vacuum cleaner that was sucking into the United States the exports of Germany, of France, of Holland, of Japan, and of course, later on, China. But how were you paying, not you, but this economy, how was it paying for the ever-expanding trade deficit? Through a tsunami of money that was coming, the profits of the German industrialists, the Japanese, the Chinese, and so on, was coming into Wall Street, seeking higher returns, closing the loop. Yeah? That's what I call the Global Minotaur. Don't ask me why. I've used an ancient Greek mythological narrative in order to make it more palatable to my daughter. Not to my daughter, but, you know, to recalcitrant readers like my daughter. And what I said at the end of the book was 2008 killed that system. Even though the American trade deficit recovered, it was no longer able to stabilize global capitalism. And I was saying at the end of the book, and this is what you mentioned, that either we're going to have a new Bretton Woods that recalibrates and rebalances global capitalism through cooperation between Europe, China, and the United States, or we're going to be in trouble, and I'm afraid that we're in trouble. And what you now see, the trade wars, the support that parochialism is receiving all over Europe, in this country with Trump and so on, is, if you want, just nothing more than a symptom of these unsustainable growing imbalances, a global capitalism that has lost its space and its poise. And if this continues, I very much fear that my daughter's generation isn't going to be in dire straits.
In a recent interview, you mentioned the idea that deflation leads to fascism, and this seems to go against the popular notion that, say, in the Weimar Republic in Germany, hyperinflation led to the fascism there. So can you explain the connection between deflation and fascism?
I will. Thank you. I'll repeat that question in my words. Your words were fine, but, you know, I'm an old professor, so I have to do this. What he's saying is that in a recent interview, I said that deflation, periods of declining consumer prices, breed political monsters, fascism, xenophobia, racism, and so on. And you correctly mentioned that there is a misunderstanding about the rise of Nazism in the 1930s in Germany. And the misunderstanding is that everybody focuses on what happened in the early parts of the 1920s in Germany, where there was rapid hyperinflation, caused primarily by the stupidity of the winners of the First World War that imposed huge reparations on the German nation, punitive reparations, which forced the German Central Bank to print money in order to repay the debt, but in the end created exponentially accelerating prices until the savings of the middle class were eaten away, destroyed, and that paved the ground for Nazism. It is true that the combination of humiliation at the end of the war, of being treated that way, and a serious economic crisis fragments the political scene and makes it possible for extremists to rise up. But, and now I'm coming to your question, if you track the electoral performance of Hitler's party in Germany and prices, you'll find that during the period of rapid inflation, the Nazis were doing extremely badly in elections. They were gaining no traction politically at the polling stations. Then, hyperinflation is tamed by 1927. There's a new currency, and the Weimar Republic manages to push inflation to very low levels. Then in 1929, when the crash took place, beginning Wall Street, it always begins there, and then traveled to Europe as well, Herr Brüning, the finance minister of Germany, did exactly what the Hoover administration did here. They went into austerity, massive austerity, and the result was deflation. Prices began to fall, and unemployment, of course, ballooned. If you look at the electoral results, and I've done that, for instance, you know, local government elections, as well as federal elections in the Weimar Republic, suddenly you see, as the rate of inflation goes below zero, in other words, you have a reduction in prices, suddenly the Nazis go from 2% to 8%, 17%, 33% in the space of 18 months. That's why I'm saying that deflation breeds monsters. In Greece, my little country, we have a very proud record of having fought tooth and nail against Nazism. In the Second World War, the Wehrmacht, in the occupied territories of Europe, or countries of Europe, two countries gave them hell, Yugoslavia and Greece. They could not tame Greece. They managed to control the city centers, but they never managed to get a foothold on the countryside. They were constantly sabotaged, and that's why they committed many massacres in Greece as well as in Yugoslavia. In fact, this country, as we speak, ladies and gentlemen, the third largest party in parliament, they were sitting opposite me where my ministerial seat was, are Nazis, Greek Nazis. And they sprang up in 2012 just as prices were falling. There is no magic formula here. I'm not putting forward some kind of very sophisticated theory. All I'm saying is very simple. For capitalism to reach a stage where prices are actually falling, and falling rapidly and consistently, it must have lost its footing completely. You know, the working class is facing unemployment, and at the same time, you have small businesses who lose all custom, because when prices fall, do you know what happens? Let's say you want to buy a fridge, a refrigerator, and you can see that its price is falling. Why buy today? Why not wait a few months and buy it more cheaply? But if everybody does that, then the market for refrigerators dies. So in Germany today, Germany has benefited significantly from the European crisis and from the Greek crisis on paper, in the sense of a massive flight of money from the rest of Europe to the banks in Germany, because people fear in Italy, in Greece, in Spain, that our countries will get out of the European Union, out of the euro, the common currency, and that we will go back to an inflated currency that will lose its value. So they take their savings and then shift them to Frankfurt. You have a German government that is in surplus, and so on and so forth. At the same time, because we are all part of the same eurozone, interest rates are below zero. So what that does is that it pushes the rate of returns of pension funds, private pension funds in Germany, to negative rates. So the average middle-class person in Germany, even if they have jobs, see their nest egg come down because interest rates are negative. And that has led to the rise of the Alternative for Deutschland. It's a racist, very right-wing, xenophobic party that has gone from 0 to 13% in 1 year. And now, if there were elections today, they would get 20%. So that's what I mean by deflation is breeding political monsters. I was meaning to give another short answer, or a shorter answer, for a change.
How you doing, Dr. Varoufakis? I asked you the reception, you're still a globalist. And you said, no, you're an internationalist. And I asked, what's the difference?
Okay, that's a brilliant question, thank you. And I think that's how we will end today, yeah? Globalization, it depends on how you define it, right? But allow me to define globalization. Humanity has been globalizing in an important way from the very beginning. We're all Africans, I've been told by anthropologists. We all came from Africa and spread out. So we've been globalizing before we were human, or before we knew we were human. So the global dimension of the human existence, there's nothing new to this. But why have you noticed that the word globalization was invented in 1991? It didn't exist before. There was no such thing as globalization before 1991. It was the end of the Soviet Union, the opening up of China, and the complete emancipation of Wall Street bankers from all the shackles and constraints imposed upon them by FDR, Franklin Roosevelt, in the 1930s, and later on by LBJ. Allow me to be very straightforward. So it was the emancipation of finance. After 1991, what you have is a situation where money can, because of the internet as well, and the total deregulation, that's the word they use, not emancipation, deregulation of finance. Suddenly, bankers could press a button and trillions would just go everywhere around the world. So it was the internationalization, if you want to finance, while people remained behind walls and borders, unless they were rich or tourists. NAFTA is a very good example. I'm sure you've been to the US-Mexican border. You can see these amazing walls. The wall exists. Trump doesn't need to build it. It's there. It's been there for years. He's just going to line the pockets of his cement-producing friends by adding a lot more cement on it. But if you go to Tijuana or to, you know, El Paso and Juarez, it's a huge wall there. I mean, what else are they going to build? The Berlin Wall looks like a walk in the park compared to Juarez. Yeah? And you see the trucks going in and out with commodities, freely moving about. The money you don't even see because it's, you know, electrons going through the internet, billions flowing. It's only the people that are behind the barriers. That's globalization for me. And I'm not a globalist. I'm an internationalist. I look at borders like a scar on the face of the earth. Imagine being an extraterrestrial and approaching the planet in your own spaceship, whatever. And you look at this little planet, this blue thing, and you realize that these idiots there, the humans, they've created all these countless borders, and they say that it's a natural right to stop people from crossing them. We are a species that has populated the whole Earth. Look at us Europeans. Look at the inanity and the idiocy of Europeans. We, for 1,000 years, have been colonizing the world here. Huh? It was Norwegians that came here, whatever, I don't know. Greeks everywhere. Yeah, we're like a plague. The Brits, what can I say about the Brits? The French, the Spaniards, they destroyed South America and Central America, you know, decimated whole civilizations. You know, we destroyed the Aborigines in Australia, in New Zealand, the Maoris. We've colonized the world. And now we're complaining about immigration. I mean, how stupid is this? Now Europe has a demographic problem because we are all old farts. Yes? And the dynamics have reversed. People are coming back to Europe. I said, no, we have to build walls. We have to make sure they die in the sea, in the Aegean Sea. Because if we don't make sure they die in the Aegean Sea and to look after them on Lesbos and treat them well, then more of them will come. Oh, my God, emigration, this is an abomination. We have been doing it for 1,000 years. So I'm an internationalist and not a globalist.
How Capitalism Works and How It Fails by Yanis Varoufakis, former finance minister of Greece and a co-founder of the international grassroots Democracy in Europe movement 2025. He is the author of the international bestseller Adults in the Room and the global minotaur America, the True Causes of the Financial Crisis and the Future of the World Economy. After teaching for many years in the United States, Great Britain, and Australia, he's currently professor of economics at the University of Athens. Thanks to Mike McCormick, he recorded Yanis Varoufakis at Seattle Town Hall on May 15, 2018. You can find Mike's one-hour-plus video of the event on YouTube under Talking Stick TV. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look for the newest programs page. TUC Radio's free and depends on the support of listeners like you. Your donation keeps this program on the air. Go to TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. There you can also subscribe to weekly free podcasts. My name is Maria Glodin. Thank you for listening.